You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. Can't get enough of the Bible for Normal People? Did you know we have lots of videos on YouTube? Just go to youtube.com, search the Bible for Normal People. You'll find videos from myself and Pete talking all things Bible.
And you know, right now we actually have an episode, and this episode is a story of public deconstruction with Josh Harris, who's best known probably for his very controversial book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye.
Yeah, and I appreciated us diving into this idea of a public deconstruction and wrestling with these questions of accountability for harmful ideas that he owns while also having some grace. And how do you wrestle that even within ourselves, since we all kind of have those stories?
Right. Well, let's get to it.
Practically any issue, the inerrancy, the authority of Scripture, it all connected back to the gospel. And so you had to fight for everything with such strength, and to not fight, to ask a question or to say, hey, maybe we don't need to be so adamant about this, was like saying, hey, maybe the gospel's not such a big deal. In the settings that I was in, Scripture, sound doctrine were used to control.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Well, folks, unless you've been living under a rock or just not paying attention to any of our podcasts, you've probably heard of microdosing. And if not, just know that all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
For me, it's not about falling asleep, but staying asleep. That's where the magic happens. So taking a microdose gummy 45 minutes before bed isn't about that 10 p.m., 11 p.m., but getting me past 2 a.m. and 3 a.m., and I feel great in the morning.
And you know, microdose gummies are good for so many things like anxiety, workflow, sleeping, and stuff like that. I mean, Jared, we've had people that in our lives that have benefited from this too, not just us. Yeah. People just are discovering that, you know, this helps.
So try yours. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code NORMALPEOPLE. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com. Promo code normal people for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code normal people. Well, Joshua Harris, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's good to be here, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. Great to have you. And a lot of one of the things that Pete and I were really interested in was just your story. And you've had quite the journey, you know, writing, I guess, Dating Goodbye, being a pastor, going to seminary, going through some shifts in your beliefs. Maybe take some time here and just share a little bit about your journey with faith.
Well, the order that you listed is actually pretty important to my story. I was a pastor, and then I went to seminary, which is not not the best order to do those two things. But I grew up in a setting that I really love. I have so much appreciation for the way that my parents raised me. But like a lot of people in midlife, I'm unpacking that. I'm trying to understand that. I'm trying to understand the good and the not so good of that. But my mom and dad became Christians in the Jesus movement of the late 60s, early 70s. They got married right after they became Christians. They had me right after they got married. And they wanted to, you know, give their lives to serving the Lord. They wanted to protect me and my other siblings from the mistakes and the dangers that they had experienced in the world. And so I was raised not only in a very conservative, zealous evangelical home, but also a homeschooling family. That was a big part of our identity, that my parents pulled us out of the school system so that they could raise us up in the fear and admonition of the Lord, you know, protect us from the influences of a secular culture. And that's really all that I knew as a kid. And then later as a teenager, I followed my dad into speaking and doing conferences, and that turned into publishing a magazine for homeschool teenagers. And so I had these gifts of communication and this love for connecting with people and influencing people on a large scale. And I really used that by writing, by, you know, being a conference speaker. And that's, you know, you mentioned I Kissed Dating Goodbye. I Kissed Dating Goodbye grew out of that moment in my life where I was wanting to do something big for God. Billy Graham was my hero. I idolized Billy Graham. I wanted to you know, do something great like that with my life. And I prayed this prayer of, Lord, you know, help me write a book that will change the world. And when I Kissed Dating Goodbye was released, I thought it was the answer to that prayer. You know, it was, here was this book that was calling for people to be more zealous, more radical, not just save sex for marriage, but go even further and avoid dating altogether. Don't kiss before you're married. Don't get entangled in emotional, you know, connections with people if you're not ready for marriage. And there was such a huge reaction to that, that it just kind of confirmed my view that I was doing the Lord's work. So that's sort of the story that led up to, you know, what people know me best for.
Mm-hmm. And it's just hearing your story, just this little bit of it, Josh, it's so common that when people get to be adults, you really see how parental influence has driven so much of what we're dealing with. Mm. You know, that sounds awfully negative, but, you know, the old joke, if you've had parents, you need therapy. Right. But we all have that, right? And it's, you know, you really are a product of your parents' passions, right? And
right.
their beliefs and their thoughts. And then you wrote I Kissed Dating Goodbye. You were, how old, early 20s, as I recall?
Yeah, that's right. Young when I was 19, yeah. 20 when I wrote it. Yeah, it was released when, right, I was 21.
And can you give us, for those who might not be familiar with the book, can you just give a very quick summary synopsis of what the book's about?
Yeah, the book was a response to the True Love Waits movement that was sweeping North America and really the world. People were calling for abstinence, a greater commitment to purity. Saving sex for marriage was a big focus. There were cultural, you know, battles that were taking place around that. And I Kissed Dating Goodbye was a book that said, if we really want to be serious about honoring God and living, you know, genuine love for each other, then we need to not only avoid having sex, we need to avoid dating, which leads to temptation. Dating is practice for divorce. Dating sets us on a really dangerous trajectory. And so we should stop dating, kiss it goodbye, and instead, you know, live our lives purposely as singles, enjoy friendships, enjoy relationships, but really just focus on serving the Lord and preparing to be a good husband or wife.
Well, that, even hearing that doesn't sound too problematic. I mean, for me growing up, I would have grown up probably in a very similar culture to you, Josh. And now that we have a lot of language around maybe what I experienced as a kid as purity culture,
right,
can you maybe describe what purity culture is and how I Kissed Dating Goodbye fit or didn't fit? You know, what was the cultural moment that this was fitting into more broadly around this idea of purity culture?
Yeah, you're right. You know, purity culture wasn't a term that we used back then. I think that the place that I Kissed Dating Goodbye played is that it took a lot of the ideas that were being discussed in different subcultures of Christianity, and it popularized a lot of them for the broader evangelical community. And purity culture wasn't just shaped by my book. It was shaped by the abstinence movement. It was shaped by a reaction to a very sexualized culture, and it was essentially a hyper-focus and a, I would say, manipulation, trying to use fear to get young people to stay away from sex. And so it did that by kind of, you know, warning or threatening with the consequences of sex. And so if you have sex, you'll be used up, you will be less than, you'll be, you know, you won't get to your marriage as a virgin, you'll face all these soul ties and disappointments. So fear to keep people from doing it. And then which leads to shame, which leads to kind of a repressive attitude towards sexuality. And then I would also say promise of if you do it this way, you know, God's way, then you'll have an amazing sex life. It's so much better. The world is, you know, can't compare to what you have as a Christian within a heterosexual, you know, marriage relationship. So that was the kind of, you know, environment that we describe now as purity culture. But the outworkings of that, which I now see 20 years later, was really a distorted view of the body, a distorted view of sexuality, a distorted view of even God, I would say, and the outworking of that in people's marriages or lack of marriage or sexual dysfunction, you know, is very real. And my book played a sadly significant role in that.
Before we get there, can you just say just a word on that so we can be clear about that? You know, how, in your mind, how has that idea of purity culture and all the things that you just talked about, how has that been damaging to, you have this unique experience where a lot of people probably have shared how that purity culture has been damaging to them. Mm-hmm. So what are the stories you've heard, and maybe how has that been damaging to you too, even in your own, in your own life?
Yeah. Well, I have had a lot of those stories shared with me. I took way too long to listen. I, for a long time, wrote criticism off as people just being haters, people not being serious about holiness, or misapplying my book. And it took a lot of time. It took me failing in different ways, me being disillusioned in different ways, to finally start understanding the stories of how these ideas of purity culture, which were embodied in my book, influence people. And I think a big mistake that I made in, you know, the way I framed my book and even just the churches that I was a part of is that we tended to have one story for things. You know, if the pastor had an experience, then everyone else can have that experience. You know, if this was your experience of raising your kids or marriage, then you could just share your formula and other people could enjoy that. And as I began to hear these diverse stories, I began to see how there were these themes of, you know, fear about sex, spending so much energy trying to deny and kind of subvert your sexual desires that then when you get married, you just can't turn those on, or there's still shame around it. There's still confusion around sexuality and an inability to kind of connect with your own pleasure and so on. Another consistent theme is if you are so focused on not awakening feelings, not awakening sexual desires, well, you need to get married as soon as possible. And so people rushed into marriages, you know, and 10, 15, 20 years later, they're dealing with the fallout of that. Or they passed up relationships that they look back on and they say, why didn't I give that a chance? I was so worried about, you know, not having sex that I didn't pursue a relationship with someone that maybe I had a, you know, special connection with. So it takes time, to use the biblical language, for the true fruit of ideas to be seen. And I think with purity culture, I in hearing all these stories, not only was heartbroken by them, but I think I also, you know, it was like holding a mirror up in front of me. I began to see, wow, this has shaped me in many ways. You know, I kind of lived the book and the ideals in my own life in a really dramatic way. And, you know, my divorce is something that's public, and my ex-wife and I, we really try to honor each other by not going into the details of that. But we both would say, yeah, the purity culture structure is not something that we would want to encourage others to follow, let alone our kids. And those are conversations that we have.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, folks, I've had allergies my whole life, and I never knew what to do with them. I didn't even know that I had allergies. But anyway, one day I went to the doctor several years ago, and I said, listen, I keep having a stuffed nose, and it's just my throat hurts, and it's horrible. And he says, have you tried Claritin D? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, you have to. See, luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescriptive-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. You know, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for about 15 years, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for hikes without my eyes watering like a fountain. I can speak without feeling like a frog has jumped into my throat, and my nose isn't stuffed all the time. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, Pete, I've been pretty emotional this week, and I was trying to reflect on why that was. And it turns out, you know, my best friend from college just died. My mom's been in the hospital, and I just haven't taken the time to reflect and process all of that. And it's been coming out in all these wonky ways. And that's exactly what therapy can help with.
That's really been my experience with therapy as well. I've benefited tremendously from therapy. And I think lately I've been able to get to the point of why. It's learning to look at your situation more as an observer from the outside instead of just reacting to things, just thinking about it and processing the information. I find a lot of the problems become more manageable that way. And that's what therapy does for me.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BNP today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BNP.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Bible in that, you know, this is the Bible for normal people. So I would guess that the way the Bible was presented to you was a huge motivator for your views that within purity culture and I Kissed Dating Goodbye, but so maybe talk a little bit about that, and then how have your views on the Bible changed over these years?
Well, you know, when I was reevaluating the book, I went back and—
You mean the Bible or your book?
Oh, yeah.
Let's be clear.
Let's be clear.
Not get confused in our antecedents,
oh,
shall we?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. You mean your book.
When I was reevaluating I Kissed Dating Goodbye, I went back and reread it for the first time in a long while, and I saw just how I misuse scripture quite dramatically, you know, just picking particular verses, taking them out of context, using them in a way that carried a lot of weight, and then using illustrations from people's lives or these dramatic moments or whatever to create so much just forcefulness in terms of people feeling like I have to do it this way. This is God's best. If I don't do this, there's so much, you know, that I'll miss. There's so much that I'll lose. And I thought I was being faithful by, you know, quoting scripture and pointing to scripture. And I thought I was building my arguments around scripture. But I look back now and I see that, you know, in so many ways, I was not taking in the full arc of if you will, the kind of the story, the true narrative of redemption. I was really creating a rule book. I was using the Bible as a rule book and creating a very even more strict and extreme rule book for people when it came to dating.
By proof texting or just—
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like lifting passages that— The starting point really wasn't the Bible, is what I'm hearing you say. It was more the ideology, and then the Bible came into service.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
That's pretty common, by the way. I never do it. Jared does it once in a while. But it is, I mean, all kidding aside, this is sort of like the battle, I think, to try to listen to that overarching story as you're talking about and to try to read these things carefully with a lot of wisdom rather than just using it to baptize our views. But that's such a common thing. So as far as like now goes with the Bible, let's just talk about that for a couple of minutes. There's no right answer here. This is the Bible for normal people. People are all across the spectrum and our listeners and the people we've had on. But do you like have a connection with scripture? Do you read it? How do you read it differently? Do you expect different things from it? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I found myself a little anxious coming to this conversation with both of you because I had a feeling you'd ask me that kind of question. And And I
but there's no wrong answer.
Well, but I think that just kind of reveals my own programming in different ways, because while I've, you know, talked to a lot of people in a lot of different settings about purity culture or the ideas in my book, or, you know, even in general terms, you know, the kind of unraveling of my views on Christianity and faith, and if you want to use the word deconstruction, whatever you want to call that, I haven't necessarily had to get into the specifics, or maybe I've been avoiding the specifics of what do I think about Scripture. And I feel really conflicted about that. You know, in the last several years, I have talked about the fact that I don't feel comfortable identifying as a Christian. You know, I felt like I needed to create the space in my own life, have the freedom in my own life to explore, to try to figure out what I believed about God and spirituality and just life in general, apart from what felt like all these restrictions in, mm-hmm. you know, the evangelical, conservative evangelical world that I'd grown up in. And it was a little bit of a, you know, get me away from all of it. I'm not trying to be in the tribe anymore. I'm not trying to explain or defend what I'm doing according to all the rules that I've imbibed and I've taught and, you know, and so on.
You need to press reset.
Well, that's a great description. I felt like I needed to press reset. And so, you know, everything from walking into a church to even picking up my Bible can just be this flood of mm-hmm. all of these feelings and memories, many of them negative, sadly. I have positive ones, but it's hard for me to access those. They mm-hmm. it brings me back into the pressure of leading a church in the, you know, denomination that I was a part of. It brings me back mm-hmm. into this kind of constant pressure of making sure that I taught exactly according to the doctrine that I was supposed to be teaching according, that I was being gospel-centered enough, that I was being, you know, really teaching in an expository manner and all those kinds of things. And so I think that there are so many layers that have been kind of piled onto my view of the Bible that it's difficult for me to come to it without just feeling this angst and just right. negative energy, I guess is the best way.
I mean, it's triggering, right? I mean, it's triggering. Yeah. And by the way, that sound that you're hearing right now is the sound of several thousand of our listeners saying, yeah, that's my life as well. Mm. You know, it's triggering to have been in, let's just call it a toxic environment mm-hmm. that you participated in and actually aided and abetted. And then you sort of see, mm-hmm. no. But that doesn't let go, right? That stays in you. You carry that with you for a long time. And it takes, mm-hmm. sometimes it takes walking away from the Bible or from God or from church or from everything just to allow yourself to sort of just get to even know yourself a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
and the other thing that I think that's been interesting for me is I know that there are Christians who they come to the Bible with a different interpretive grid. You know, they're able to see it and interpret it and apply it in different ways. In the world that I was in, that would have been, those were liberals. You know, those were right. progressive Christians that were not being faithful to Scripture and so on. And so I've found it difficult at this moment in my life to open myself up to new ways of seeing Scripture. It's almost easier for me to just say, listen, guys, just bag it all. I got to walk away from all of it, than it is to shift my thinking and say, maybe I don't have to read the text this way. Maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't mean this. Maybe there's, you know, a flexibility on this particular topic or whatever it might be. That's just, I don't think the same way, but I can still find myself judging people because I spent so many years in a context where we just judged the hell out of people, you know, if they weren't as faithful as we were to Scripture and to sound doctrine.
Just to go on this idea of toxic, I just can't help but draw the analogy with like toxic relationships, where to reform that relationship, to reimagine it, to go through that process just is very challenging. In a lot of ways, the healthier or certainly easier route is to just cut it off and to go a different route and to make a different path. And that's kind of what I'm hearing is, and I think that's true for a lot of people within Christianity is, yeah, that just seems super murky. And I don't know how I go down that without a lot of pain and a lot of trauma and a lot of things where this other path of just, let's just let that go and maybe go a different way just seems like a much easier. And I don't mean that as like a cop-out. I mean, maybe that is the better sometimes way to move forward.
Well, I as you're talking, I'm just realizing that in the settings that I was in, and again, I know this is not all of Christianity by any means, but in the settings that I was in, scripture, sound doctrine were used to control. Mm-hmm. It was about keeping people in line, and that was framed in terms of guarding the gospel. Sound doctrine was important because the gospel was always at stake. You know, gender roles ultimately connected back to the gospel. And so practically any issue, you know, the inerrancy, the authority of scripture, it all connected back to the gospel. And so you had to fight for everything with such strength and to not fight, to ask a question or to say, hey, maybe we don't need to be so adamant about this, was like saying, hey, maybe the gospel's not such a big deal. And so fear and control are such themes of how scripture was used and how it was applied in a community and in the Christian culture that I was in. And it's sad that when I come to scripture, it's like I feel that fear and control. Mm-hmm. I know it doesn't have to be that way. I interact with Christians that have a freedom and there's a living nature to scripture. There's an openness and a growth that's present, a joy. And I'm trying to learn from that. I want to be open to that.
So right now, with respect to just your view of your Christian faith, you're trying to figure things out and see where you land and just see where you are. And let's throw Jesus and God into this mix as well. Like where, again, I'm asking the question because those are the big questions people ask when they're going through this process. Like, I don't even know what God is anymore or if God is. I mean, just Jesus, you know, he's some Jewish guy, right? Or the Bible or the Christian faith. I mean, look at all the damage that it's done. What is your relationship with all those things at this point? That's a big question.
Yeah, that's a huge question. I would say I'm...
And throw in the universe. What do you think of the universe?
The universe. I would say that I'm very much in process. I don't want to try to land or label myself or say, here's where I am, you know, or join a new tribe. But I definitely also don't want to just kind of be hedging my bets to say, yeah, well, I still love Jesus, but, you know, I don't know. I would just say I'm not sure. You know, I'm not pretending that I am following, practicing, believing in all the ways that for years I believed defined you as a Christian. So,
but how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like I recognize that I was in a, you know, a context that had a very narrow definition of that. And and so how I feel about it is I feel free. I mean, I feel like I have more of a possibility of actually encountering who God is or who he might be than I did in the mindset and the framework that was so defined by fear and control.
So there's always that lingering, maybe fear factor, but also I'm sensing a hopefulness in even in not knowing and having the freedom to say, I just don't know. And maybe to encounter God differently than what had been sort of a life-sucking kind of context you were in. I mean, just from your own experience.
Yeah, right? I would say that I have a hopefulness for sure.
Well, I think that's really fair. I did want to make sure we had time to come to this question, is that, you know, you have experience being very publicly an advocate for evangelical purity culture and then having this public change of heart. So How have you navigated this tension between justice and grace? You know, between needing to be accountable for the ideas mm-hmm. that you help promote, but also needing the grace and space to change your mind and have it be a mistake. You've mentioned that, and I've heard other podcasts you've been on or other interviews where you've owned up to those things, mm-hmm. and these things can be forgiven. So I'm thinking this, of course, in light of cancel culture conversations mm-hmm. that you are, whether you, of course, like it or not, I'm sure not like it, are kind of right in the middle of. So how have you navigated this justice and grace mistakes that can be forgiven and accountability conversation?
Oh, boy. I would say that I just try to keep the focus on genuine human interactions with people. And I know that that's hard sometimes when that's happening over social media or, you know, different forms of mass communication. But I try to just keep remembering that we're all humans, we're individuals, and we're at different places. And I think that I understand people who have been really hurt by, harmed by my book, how deep that runs because of the significance of the decisions that you make. And I recognize that, you know, my book took on a lot of authority. It was claiming to be speaking from the Bible. It was handed to people by their pastors and parents. You know, it was in the Christian bookstore. And so when that's given to someone at a formative time in your life, it can take mm-hmm. on a lot of authority. And so I've had people say to me, well, listen, people just need to take responsibility. You didn't force them to read the book. You didn't force them to do these things. And, you know, sure, that you can say that that's true, but I think I have a real sense of regret and responsibility because I understand in a religious context how shaping and how formative those ideas can be. And it does feel like someone is coming and saying, you have to do this. And I think that I know that I can't fix, you know, these things by my apologies. I know that, you know, there's a lot more involved that shaped the world that we were all in at the time and so on. But I just feel like if no one takes that step to say, let's take responsibility, if no one takes a step to say, here's the part I played, you know, it doesn't fix anything, but I just want to acknowledge that and try to do better and try to, you know, lift up other voices that are offering alternatives. If nobody does that, then we don't learn from the mistakes. You know, we don't grow. We don't offer any kind of healing to others. And so that's the mindset that I bring. And I encounter people that are, you know, just really pissed off. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I encounter people who are also very gracious and who, you know, express forgiveness to me. And I also encounter people who say, please just go away. You know, like we don't ever want to hear your voice again. You shouldn't speak. You shouldn't have any influence. You shouldn't have any platform. And I understand that too. I think I've had to wrestle with that the most because in many ways, I mean, that's kind of like the heart of shame, you know? It's like because of what I did or who I am, I should just disappear. I should, you know, literally just be canceled from almost like the earth. And I've had to wrestle with that and say, no, you know what? I am going to just continue to exist. I'm not going to be controlled by some new group of people. I'm going to speak up because I feel like it's part of a healing process for me personally. I'm going to speak up because, you know, I think there are people who will listen to this coming from me that they might not listen to somebody else. And if, you know, just one person can experience some kind of closure or healing from knowing that I am not only sorry, but I'm wrestling with these things myself, then for me, that's worth it. But that is a kind of a daily, weekly challenge for me.
A calling is a powerful thing. It's a very strong belief that there is something bigger for you. It's about who you are and where you're going in life. You may be in college, you may be halfway through a career, but you want something different.
There's a place for you at Union Presbyterian Seminary, where students are prepared for a call to ministry. At Union, you will find a diverse community. You'll find students from different denominations and professors who will listen to you and challenge you. You'll find people who help you find your own path.
You'll find a school where financial realities matter. Union offers generous financial aid, and it meets you where you are with three different platforms for learning: residential, online, and hybrid.
You'll find a world-class faculty who will invest in you, a community long after you graduate that supports you and equips you for service and for leadership. Safwat Marzouk, who has been on the podcast here on The Bible for Normal People, is a faculty at Union Presbyterian Seminary and is slated to write one of our upcoming commentaries. It's no secret, if you're a listener to the podcast, how much Pete and I have relied on our seminary education and how much that has shaped our view of the world and all of our work here at The Bible for Normal People.
It's your call. Respond with Union Presbyterian Seminary. To learn more, go to upsem.edu or email admissions@upsem.edu.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you were very young when you conceived the book and then when you wrote it. And I really appreciate what you're saying here. And not to detract from that, because I think you're right in you know, the personal accountability. But part of me also says, and again, this, I don't want anyone to mishear me, that I'm not taking any responsibility away from you, blah, blah, blah. But somebody published you, right? And you were part of a context that encouraged this. And, you know, someone of your age might not have had the wisdom and the life experience to notice what was happening. And I wonder how much of the responsibility goes to the larger
system.
Christian cultural system, mm-hmm. right, that said, sure, you're qualified to write a book of incredible complexity that goes into the depth of our humanity, human sexuality. And yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out, we'll publish it, right? But I think, you know, again, this is my impression, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were used. I think you wrote something that was very electrifying, and I think people thought they could make some money off of it. That's at least part of it, you know. And sure, it aids and abets, you know, a certain ideology, but I think a little bit of thought by those who make these kinds of decisions should have led them to say, "Not yet. This is not something that someone this young should write."
Well, I think
any thoughts?
I think there's truth to the idea that there is a system in place that's driven by, you know, market realities. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was the height of the, you know, Christian publishing, you know, world, CBA and Christian bookstores. I mean, just not only did you have, whatever, 20 years ago, 60-70% of people identifying as evangelical or Christians in America, but you had this whole network of Christian bookstores. This is before Amazon. This was before, bookstores were wiped out, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there was a whole machine that was spreading ideas, and evangelicalism was so movement-based. You had Promise Keepers, you had True Love Waits, you had, you know, the ideas of purity culture, and on Christian, you know, contemporary music was huge. And so, yeah, that machine is real. I do think there's a need for responsibility. But I would also just say of myself, I wanted that too. In other words, I wanted to be used. I wanted to be, you know, famous for Jesus. I wanted to sell tons of books. I continued to write books. As I grew older, I should have gone back and reevaluated the content of the books sooner than I did. I should have been open to that. But it what it teaches me is how people can get locked into beliefs and ideas and ideologies, and it has nothing to do with scripture. It has nothing to do with what they actually believe if they were forced to really honestly, you know, critique and think about it. It's shaped by, because, you know, the fact that it's their job. It's shaped by that this is their community. It's shaped by, well, I can't question that, or this would fall apart. I'd lose my role, you know, all those types of things. And so that fear is behind so much of it, but what we dress it up as is, well, this is sound doctrine. This is, you know, This is what I believe. It's right here in Scripture.
This is what Jesus and Paul thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're coming full circle then, because, you know, I think Pete's mentioned this before. We have a lot of listeners who've changed their minds about God, the Bible, church, sin. I mean, Pete and I have too over the years. Have you found it difficult to forgive yourself? Because I think, you know, just thinking about what advice you might have for people who struggle with a lot of guilt, because it comes from both sides. Mm-hmm. There's this guilt over what they used to believe, right? So I'm guilty that I used to believe this thing, and I probably hurt people along the way by these old beliefs I had. Yeah. But I'm also now guilty for having new beliefs because my old way of thinking is sort of shaming me for my new way of thinking. And it's all very confusing. It's sort of getting this guilt from both sides. So how have you navigated, you know, forgiving yourself and moving forward? I think you hinted at this a little bit where you're kind of criticized from all sides in some ways.
Well, I think it's an ongoing process. I think it's that process of forgiving yourself is so important, because if you can't do that, you can't show compassion to other human beings who are going to be on the same pathway. And if we don't figure this out in different ways, not just related to books that are written or even just religious viewpoints and so on, if we don't have space in our view of humanity and the world for people to grow and change, then everybody has to be locked into their, you know, immaturity. Everybody has to be locked into their bad doctrine. Everybody has to be locked into their bad ideology. If the moment somebody starts questioning something that's problematic, we just want to cancel them for, you know, you got this wrong and so you should be punished forever, there's no space for compassion, for compromise, for growth, for, you know, just a safer, gentler, kinder world. And so I have, you know, tried to look back on who I was at that time and say, okay, what shaped me? What was going on there? What was good about that? You know, there was a genuine desire to try to help people. There was fear in my heart. I have to have compassion to say, yeah, I was afraid. I was receiving these messages from other people. I thought these things with such conviction, and I tried to express that. And even when you have good intentions, you can hurt people. Mm-hmm. And that shapes a compassion towards myself, and then it also shapes a compassion towards people that I interact with now, you know, that I think are really wrong about things. And it gives me an ability to hope for them that they will grow and experience new truths and be able to change. But it's a it's a winding road for me, for sure.
You know, I can't speak for Pete, but I mean, Pete, you can speak for yourself, but I think neither one of us are sitting here without, I think we have a soft spot for that, because neither one of us have this podcast or have the ability to speak to people in the way we do without people showing us compassion that, you know, I was saying things that were hurtful 20 years ago, the things that weren't helpful to people, you know, in from a large groups of people as a pastor. And so, you know, I appreciate what you're saying. I think that's really true.
Yeah, I think those are very wise and seasoned and encouraging words to end on, Josh. Mm-hmm. So, listen, we really appreciate your time, taking the time to be with us all the way from someplace in Canada, very far away. 3,000 miles away, beautiful Vancouver. So anyway, but thank you for taking the time. We really enjoyed having a chance to talk with you.
Thanks for giving me the space to just think about these things. I really am grateful that you are having these kind of conversations. I know a lot of people really look to the work you're doing and find a lot of encouragement, and I'm grateful.
All right. Thank you, Josh. See ya.
All right, everyone, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening and supporting our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And of course, we want to give a big shout out to our producers group who support us over on Patreon. They are the reason we are able to keep bringing podcasts and other content to you. So a big thanks to Aaron Neff, Bruce Sims, Dave Pfeiffer, Greg Jones, Joan Gudeman, Chris Pearson, Matt Porter, Peter and Mary Wall, Sam Oldham, and Travis Jance. If you would like to help support the podcast, head over to patreon.com/thebibleformalpeople, where for as little as $3 a month, you can receive bonus material, be part of an online community, get course discounts, and much more.
Thanks as always to our team. Executive producer, Megan Kamick. Audio engineer, Dave Gerhardt. Creative director, Tessa Stoltz. Marketing wizard, Reed Lively. Transcriber and community champion, Stephanie Spate. And web developer, Nick Striegel. For Pete, Jared, and the entire Bible for Normal People team, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Well, I want to. Sorry.
I'm so sorry.
I just want to make sure that it's okay. It's
no, we'll cut that out. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Thank you. Dave, cut that out. Dave's our producer.
Yeah. Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.